This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I was born in the city, way too late. People before me done their crimes. Now I'm living in too late times.
Europe has another war on its hands. The enemy in the summer of 25 is fire. Aircraft and firefighters flock to the south from all countries. Damaging and deadly fires are raging in Spain, France, Greece, Albania, and more. European leaders and media make clear the cause is climate-induced record heat and drought. More record wildfires are burning across Canada, coast to coast and in between. The North Pacific has been in a marine heat wave for months. Japan and Korea were unbearably hot. The Middle East is too, including Israel and Iran and Turkey, where fires rage. Some scientists say it is time to explore turning down the sun. It is called solar radiation management. Similar to the cooling effect of volcanoes, high-flying planes release sulfur particles to deflect sunlight and encourage clouds. Other experts warn of giant risks, things like monsoon failures endangering hundreds of millions. Serious people suggest solar radiation management may not work as a last resort. If we wait until 2 or 3 degrees of warming, various tipping points and unstoppable polar ice melt could already be triggered. Does that mean humans should try geoengineering now? All this is raised by one of America's most eminent climate scientists, Dr. Michael McCracken. He speaks with UK videographer and climate journalist Nick Breeze in a YouTube interview released May 15, 2025. With Nick's kind permission, I'm going to play that interview now. At the end, you can find some other points of view, plus a new song from Radio EcoShock, Too Late Times.
I'm speaking with Dr. Mike McCracken, a pioneering climate scientist whose research on atmospheric physics and global climate change has significantly advanced our understanding of human impacts on the climate system. His leadership roles at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and the US Global Change Research Program established him as a key figure in climate science. As chief scientist for the Office of the US Global Change Research Program, he played a crucial role in advising multiple administrations on climate science and policy. In this episode, we explore counter and crossover views to opposition to solar geoengineering. With great respect to experts on all sides of this discussion, Mike offers some compelling reasons as to why we cannot just denounce proposals to cool the planet. This is at a time when the UK government is significantly funding research into solar geoengineering. With such a split in views on this topic, I hope you take the time to consider what Mike says and also what Professor Raymond Pierre Humbert says in a previous episode in order to inform your own perspective. In the next episode, I'll be speaking with Alexander MacDonald, a former head of US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, NOAA, who is the leading proponent behind supergrids for supplying the world with clean, abundant, and resilient electrical energy, without which all our dreams of the future will fail. Thanks to all subscribers. Please do like and share and feedback in the comments. I do try to respond to all as much as I can. Thank you. Mike, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me today. It's great to see you and get your views on this topic. Can you start by giving us your assessment of where climate is today, where we're going, and then in relation to solar radiation management or SRM, how does SRM fit into a roadmap to the future?
I used to say we were having an environmental dilemma. Now I think we have a real pickle in the situation. Global warming is continuing. Emissions are going up. It's clearly related to human activities. To stop climate change, we have to not only stop increasing emissions, we have to get emissions to zero, which is something that really hasn't been done for prior technology switches. When you went from wood to coal, we kept burning wood. When you went from coal to oil and gas, you kept burning coal. We have to actually get to zero emissions of all of them to stop further warming. And it's now roughly at 1.5 degrees of global average temperature increase, which is the aspirational limit for the warming that was put into the Paris Accord. We're going to just go rapidly past that, perhaps to as much as double that amount, even if we're working hard at cutting emissions. Cutting emissions is clearly the way to go. We have to do that. Mitigation, we have to do that. But it's just proving hard to do, not just due to recalcitrance of governments, but there's just a tremendous amount to do and a real requirements for new approaches. So temperatures are headed up. And I guess I would say those of us who are pushing for intervention have a sense that we're as high as we want to go. We're already suffering tremendous amounts. Those of us in mid-latitudes aren't suffering so much, and we have access to air conditioning and other kind of ways to deal with the climate. But if you live in the subtropics, if you live in the equatorial regions, I mean, there's no way to provide air conditioning for all of those in India or all of those in Africa in any near-term timescale that matches what's going to happen with climate change. So we're in a really serious situation. The metric that is used in the international negotiations, this metric of global average temperature change, which is really average over the last 10 years of the global average, of the seasonal average, or of the daily average over the oceans and the land, is about the most innocuous metric you could think of in trying to talk about what the impacts of climate change are going to be for us. If you're in some areas in low latitudes, heat index is what's really terrible. We have high heat index in the United States and Texas. How do they survive? They go inside. They're in air-conditioned spaces. So that's the way to adapt to it. But we're also destabilizing ice sheets. We're starting having accelerated levels of sea level rise. And if you go back into the paleoclimatic record, which is sort of where I started way back in my dissertation days long ago, you see that the potential for sea level rise is huge. I mean, it could be meter or meters per century with the warming that we're having. That occurred in the past, so it's not something that couldn't occur now. So we're changing the climate. I guess the big difference with us, or disagreement or exception that we take with the traditional view is, the traditional view is right now is sort of that, well, we can just keep inching up and we'll get to maybe 2.5 degrees C warming, global warming. And by then, well, we'll deal with it. Well, last time it was 2.5 degrees C, sea level was tens of meters higher than it is now. That's just an unacceptable consequence. So the notion of intervention is, can we do something to shave off the peak level while we really get emissions and everything else under control? Can we try and return to what some of us call a more healthy climate situation as it was in maybe the second half of the 20th century?
And you just mentioned how innocuous this metric is of using this sort of global average compared to the pre-industrial period. Is there a better way to express urgency? You point to sea level rise, heat index, and they register with people, but it's been very difficult to communicate urgency to the man in the street, to people who are just sort of going about their daily lives. Is there a metric that you've come across that's helped communicate that better?
Well, to communicate to the public, what we and other nations have done is try and do climate change assessments. What matters is the impacts to people, and so tends to be more local than global. And so what you want to do is, if you live on the coastlines, sea level rise and storm surges are a key issue. If you're a farmer, changing the precipitation pattern and how you can grow food is an issue. If you're in some regions, it's heat, and heat index is the issue. And you're going, I mean, they've been having terrible kinds of situations in India and elsewhere with very high temperatures and the impacts that you have. In other areas, it's water resources. In other areas, you know, it's sort of your cultural identity. If we're going to, are we going to have sea level rise flood low-lying islands? What's happening in the Arctic? I mean, I was a part of the Arctic synthesis team for the first Arctic assessment, and it was really interesting what the people up there said. They basically said, climate change is destroying our culture. And we from lower latitudes were there, sort of there listening in the mid latitudes. And they said, well, wait a minute, I don't understand. You're driving a snowmobile and you're working at an oil pipeline company or something. What do you mean that climate change is destroying your culture? And they would say this, and we kept listening. And it turns out to survive in the Arctic for thousands of years, as these people have done, you have to develop a culture where you share resources, you share everything. You go on a community hunt for a whale, or you go on for a seal, and you share them. Because if you're an individual hunter and you one year break your leg, you're not going to survive the winter. I mean, you die. So individualism in the Arctic sort of died, and their culture was not having money to buy things and exchange between individuals, but community efforts to gather food and bring it in and share it with widows. And then the widows would be helping sew the nets or something. And so it was a completely different lifestyle of subsistence living, living off the natural world and sharing the bounty of it. And so now you say, well, now we don't have sea ice. Well, I can't go out. That makes it hard to capture seals and whales. Okay, I can go out of boats, and now they're trying to get even power boats, or I can go out in kayaks or something. But it's much harder to do, because when you had sea ice, the whales and the seals, they had to come up for air. And so what did you do? You waited right there, just like the polar bears would wait right where there was a break in the ice, and that's how you did it. And they had these wonderful ways of knowing about nature. And so all these things are destroyed. If you tell people in one place, this is happening somewhere else, it doesn't really help as much as telling people about what's happening locally. But there are some global metrics you can look at. You know, you can look at how severe tropical cyclones are becoming more likely and more disruptive. Temperature change is different in different places. It's much higher than the global average in high latitudes. It's about double that on land and mid latitudes. And you say, well, temperature change isn't so bad in low latitudes. Well, wait a minute. That's because the heat that would raise the temperature is going into evaporating moisture from the ocean. And if moisture goes up into the atmosphere, it's going to come down more, and you get these drenching kind of flooding rains. And what do you do when you're in some of those communities and you have a meter of rain or something from a tropical cyclone? It's hard to imagine a meter of rain, but that kind of thing has happened, you know, in a day or 2 days of storms. Where do you live? Do you live on the coastal plain that's getting flooded? Do you live in the valleys where all the water's coming down? Do you live on the hillsides that slide into the valleys? No wonder they evacuate the area and come and become refugees and head to higher places that are richer and more developed and can take them in. For people, it's where they are that you have to talk about.
You talked about localization, and pretty much anywhere you go in the world now, people are seeing quite drastic changes where they live. I mean, across Europe, we're seeing pretty much not full-blown catastrophes, but severe flooding events more or less on a daily basis throughout the year. And we're 1.5 degrees, using that sort of innocuous metric, we're 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial now. We're going higher. You've already said, you know, around 2.5 degrees plus. Floods, droughts, fires, food security, all these things are on the table. What would you set, using that same metric, as a safe, a place we should be trying to get to in terms of above the pre-industrial, in terms of, was it 0.5 degree, 1 degree, zero?
So, with respect to global average temperature, the world was doing pretty well in trying to adapt between the mid and late 20th century. And at that period, the global average temperature was between maybe a half and 1 degree Celsius. And so that's sort of where you want to go back. This isn't a precise knob. There's always going to be variability that, so it goes up and down. The aim is to get back into a range of conditions that are more easily adjusted to. Now, some of the talk when it's about intervention, oh, well, I want to go back to pre-industrial. I don't know anybody in any country that really wants to go back there. They've basically tended to adapt to what was happening in the mid-20th century or latter half of the 20th century with respect to where food is grown, what crops are grown, what infrastructure we have. The one reason to maybe consider going back for to lower conditions for maybe a couple of decades is to try and get the destabilization of glaciers under control. If you could get back and somehow get some of that heat out of the ice sheets that has gotten in there, that might help stabilize the ice sheets and the ice streams that are coming down. And you might say, well, okay, maybe I'd do that for just a brief time. I wouldn't want to try and stay there, but I might try and do that for a while because 20,000 years ago, at the peak glacial period, sea level was lower by 120 meters. 120 meters, just 200 centuries ago, it was lower. And for the next 120 centuries, 12,000 years, till about 8,000 years ago, sea level rose on average a meter every century when the reconstruction of the global average temperature was going up on average 1 degree every 2,000 years, every 20 centuries. We went up 1 degree in one century. We're going to go up another, say, 2 degrees in this century. And you go, wow, the potential for sea level rise is huge. And during that period, about two-thirds of the ice that was up on land melted into the ocean, and there's another one-third left in Antarctica and Greenland. And that's another 60 meters. And if you go back way in Earth history, when it was different, but go back 30, 50 million years ago, there weren't really polar ice sheets. All of that ice was in the ocean. Well, if we're headed up to that global level, the consequences of having sea, even if it takes, millennia to try for all of it to melt, which maybe it does, that's just overwhelming on humanity. I mean, our whole economy will be spent on relocating people away from coastlines or something. So we have to stop, try and stop the ice sheets. And that's a reason that a number of us think we don't want to go higher. Now, intervention is not a solution. Solution is to get the atmospheric concentration under control. But can we control some of the worst impacts by intervening is the question.
The previous guest on this podcast pointed out that even since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015, the amount of emissions that we've added to the burden is in the hundreds of billions of tons. If you were going to go back to 1970s, 1980s levels for a 0.5 to 1 degree level, I mean, that's colossal, isn't it, in terms of the mitigation job that we're undertaking?
In addition to reducing emissions, an emerging approach is sort of called carbon dioxide removal. Let's pull it out of the atmosphere somehow. This is what we sort of call in the United States a gigantic unfunded mandate. So, who in the world is going to pay for it? And right now, the costs are pretty high. The one hope is there are some ideas starting to emerge about how to pull CO2 out, not at a high rate, but at a helpful rate that won't be quite so costly. But they're also quite, imaginative approaches for spreading around the world. It's going to be hard to get back there. That's why, of course, mitigation is so important. I mean, one of your previous speakers I know said going to intervention is like throwing in the towel. Well, a number of us thought about that. And we sort of listed more than a dozen reasons why those for intervention are for more aggressive mitigation. First, we want a healthy planet, so we don't want to go up there anyway. But second, there are limits to what you can do with intervention to try and offset it. You can't just sort of, oh, well, I'm indefinitely going to keep burning and I'll intervene more and more. There are limits to what you can do without having some other kinds of adverse impacts. And so you want to keep what happens in terms of emissions as low as you possibly can. And then what we want to do is actually keep the temperature off and the general climate and water vapor evaporation, everything that intensify the weather, keep that all down as we can to try and help make it so we're not having terrible impacts around the world, especially in low latitudes. I mean, I think what we haven't done in thinking about it enough, the information's all out there, but the goal isn't just to have a nice climate. The goal is to achieve something like the Sustainable Development Goals. That is, that everybody in the world has a chance to sort of live and survive and produce goods and have food and all the different Sustainable Development Goals. And if you look at the UN reports on this, we're falling behind on the Sustainable Development Goals. Climate change is making it worse. If you warm the oceans, the fisheries go elsewhere, or they aren't so strong, or the coral reefs are bleached away, which are the sort of repositories for biodiversity in the ocean. So you just lose more and more as you get warmer and warmer. And we really, if we can, want to try and keep it down while we deal with this other problem. We should have been dealing with intervention, you know, long ago. I mean, in the U.S., it first came to presidential and congressional level consideration in 1965. The President's Science Advisory Council said this is a problem. It was recognized on the global stage not much later than that. It was scientifically recognized in 1896 by Arrhenius and even earlier by others. But, you know, it took a while to confirm the scientific objections to Arrhenius's hypothesis. And so we've known about it a long time. You know, we're a third of a century past the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which said we should limit emissions to avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference. And what's happened? Emissions are still going up. Still going up. And fossil fuels are still 80% as a source of global energy. That's huge. We've just been dawdling along, and so now those of us who live in Arizona say we just have to go to the sort of last resort we have to try and offset some of the impacts and the warming that, while all the mitigation and all the carbon dioxide removal is done, that can be done.
You know, we're at this point now. I mean, you're saying that mitigation is critical, but it should be, it's not an either or situation. It should be done as part of the mix, and greenhouse gas removal. There's no technology is there at the moment that is scalable to meet the challenges that we're talking about. So you're kind of left with SRM, whereas, is that how you see it? That we simply are left with this one intervention option because even the political headwinds are against you, all of us at the moment.
Well, there are two other ways that sort of have to be mentioned. One is, can we adapt to it and build our resilience and just sort of live in a warmer world? And that seems that's something we're going to have to do as much as we can, but there are real limits to what you can do. Relocating your capital like they're doing in Indonesia because of sea level rise and other kinds of things. Those are big kinds of things to do. Much of the population lives in coastal cities, urbanized areas in coastal cities. So there's limits to adaptation and resilience. And then the other one that former U.S. science advisor John Holdren used to sort of put there was suffering. You know, you could just continue to have an increasing number of these terrible disasters that are happening when we have hurricanes and stuff. I mean, it used to be that our infrastructure was put in, and here a typical standard was, well, I want to make it resilient to a 1 in 100 year flood occurrence or something. Well, if you look at some results that Jim Hansen and his colleagues have put together about the likelihood of very hot summers, for example, which is what you would worry about for heat waves in cities and the need for air conditioning. So he looked at observations. This is not modeling. This is just observations. He looked at observations in the mid-20th century and sort of found a point for this is the sort of one in a thousand time of summer-long heat that would occur in land areas of the Northern Hemisphere. And he said, okay, I'm going to keep that value here steady, and then I'm going to watch is what's happened over time. But what's happened over time is by the time you get to the present, that particular condition is not occurring just one time in a thousand. It's occurring about 20% of the time, 200 times more likely for that kind of very hot condition in the past, to which our buildings were perhaps designed for. When Europe was rebuilt after World War II in some of those cities, they based it on conditions, weather conditions at the time. And so you didn't put air conditioners in every apartment in Paris or something like that, or London or wherever you want to go. The buildings there were built to the weather that was occurring. So you dealt with it by having windows on both sides and the air could flow, cool air could flow through or something. But now you look at it and you're getting these heat waves and you want to have air conditioning. It's expensive, sort of more expensive than to put it in afterwards than it is to have done it early. And so we're having these changes and extremes that are going to put a lot of pressure on society, more and more pressure on society and people, especially in low latitudes, especially because the heat index matters, what the humidity of the air is matters. My dad was in heating and refrigeration. And if you want to reduce the dew point that comes up, the wet bulb temperature, and once you get there, it takes about 20 times as much electric energy to run an air conditioning device to pull the moisture down 1 degree as it does to cool dry air 1 degree. Well, so if you keep raising this, the amount of moisture in the air that people are experiencing to above what are considered comfortable or survivable levels, this gets very expensive to do in terms of air conditioning in low latitudes and now mid latitudes.
There are a number of scientists who and eminent people who talk a lot about climate change, and they're saying that with aggressive mitigation, if we could get the emissions right down by, say, mid-century or around that sort of period, then the level of atmospheric greenhouse gases will naturally start to come down quite rapidly due to carbon sinks. Is this something that you see as a viable path with aggressive mitigation?
Well, it's very interesting, and I've heard that several times. And there are some people, you know, who talk about the persistence of CO2 going out a very long period of time, and some that talk about this rate of removal. We don't have, you know, good observational experience of what happens when you have low emissions and how long it will continue. And so there's an actual difference in views about this. As we go down towards zero emissions, we're also going to be reducing the concentrations or the emissions of the short-lived species like methane and tropospheric ozone and the amount of black carbon that goes up in the atmosphere. And so the force, as we go down in emissions, the overall forcing is going to go down with all of these too. But when you suddenly reach zero, there isn't some new process that starts. What's happening in the world when you put CO2 into it, if I emit CO2, and they've done some model experiments with this, which are interesting, put CO2 in. Well, if you have an excess in the atmosphere above the chemical equilibrium of the ocean, some of it spreads into the mixed layer of the ocean. If you have a higher CO2 level, that in certain circumstances, when there's water and nutrients, helps terrestrial biology, plants grow more. And so what we have recognized all through this rising situation of emissions is about half of what's emitted stays in the atmosphere, and about a quarter goes into the terrestrial biosphere, and a quarter goes into the mixed layer of the ocean. So that's sort of an initial redistribution that occurs over relatively short periods. The oceans are changing temperature, they take up CO2, they put it back. And so that's a relatively short-term adjustment. But once it's emitted, that sort of comes into balance for past emissions. And so you can have some reduction as new emissions sort of do that adjustment, but that doesn't take you very far. After that, where does the CO2 go? Well, there's a pretty long time constant for it to go into the roots and the permanent storage on land and carbon. And it's pretty slow mixing into the deep ocean. In fact, that was something that was a criticism of Arrhenius at the time when he proposed saying CO2 could go up. People said, well, look how much CO2 is in the ocean. It'll all get taken up by the ocean. We don't have to worry. It'll take a long time. And it took until the 1950s and some atmospheric nuclear testing and other things that let scientists, Roger Revelle, and who was the teacher of Al Gore and others, look at how radionuclides, radioactive carbon-14 and things, went into the ocean. And it turned out there is this mixed layer. It's only 100, 200 meters deep. And that gets mixed by the weather, the winds and everything mix it. But to go below that, you have to go down in the sinking water is in the polar regions. So very cold, dense polar regions will go down. And they only go down to a certain extent. And it turns out it really helps when you have sea ice formation and not making really salty water to go deeper. And as they go down, the water in the most of the ocean gets pushed up. And so any CO2 that is trying to diffuse down gradually through the layers of the ocean gets pushed back up. And so you don't get to mix what you put in the atmosphere into the whole ocean, except on the time that you're recycling water into the deep ocean. And that's 1,000 years or 2,000 years based on radiocarbon measurements. So you don't start pulling this amount of CO2 that we put in back toward the ocean sediments, is where it got deposited originally, or sometimes in peat bogs and that became coal. But that takes a long time to happen. And so there's a real sense that the simple model fits to what's been happening suggests that there will be this ongoing rate of decay. But the more sophisticated models don't. And I've been trying to look at that and get some sort of consensus answer. The two sides don't seem to talk to each other very well. And I think one has to worry that the CO2 is going to last quite a long time. A substantial fraction of it will last quite a long time. And we don't really want that to happen. So I think that the case times more like 1,000 years than it is 50 years, which is.
We will be right back with UK climate videographer Nick Breeze in conversation with well-known American climate scientist Dr. Mike McCracken.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Welcome back. We continue with Nick Breeze of Climate Gen, talking with Dr. Mike McCracken. Nick's video is titled, 2.5 degrees C to 3 degrees C is not viable. Dr. Mike McCracken's case for solar radiation management.
In that sort of time frame then, and if you look at the time frame we have, which is not 1,000 years, it's this period where we have to reduce emissions, we have to find a way of bringing down atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gas. I mean, it rather looks like we're going straight through the 2.5, and is 2.5, it's not, as you said, it's not a dial where we can sort of turn it to where we want. It's literally, that's probably a transition to somewhere else. How do you see a vision of this that is actually a pathway to the future that people can believe in, or at least, conceptualize?
The first challenge is just at least having a discussion of it. And right now, the prevailing view has been, ever since the UN Framework Convention, everything, that emissions reduction can do that. And that's what we've got to do. And that's, no question, we want to have it happen, but it's proving very difficult. very difficult to do. But those of us on intervention are also working on mitigation. I mean, we think that's absolutely essential too. There's a lot of research going into what solar radiation management can do. So the first thing is to get it into the mix of considerations as a supplementary effort. I mean, there are questions of who's going to govern it. My view, my personal view, is that the important reason for doing it is to help alleviate the situation in the underdeveloped and developing world that is most vulnerable. And so it's basically to allow achievement of the sustainable development goals. The United Nations has a whole structure for trying to promote sustainable development goals. And so one could get, if their structure would say, look, we've got to do something and everything, it could draw ideas and input from other UN organizations and make a recommendation to the General Assembly and the Security Council and say, you know, this is what to do, or this is, you know, what can be done. This is an option. And if you go back to 2007 and 8, the UN Commission on Sustainable Development actually asked for advice from the scientific community on how to do it. They were a little not happy, I guess, with the IPCC assessments. What scientists basically say in the assessments is, if this happens, this is what will happen. If this is done, this is what will happen. And they basically asked the scientists, a scientific group, what should we do? Well, scientists are very reluctant to get to the word should, because there's a whole lot of different considerations that come into making a decision. But we did respond to them in a way that said, if you want to get to this point, a condition so you can achieve the sustainable development goals, these are the things you have to do to get there. And so that's where we are again. You know, if they want to achieve the sustainable development goals, there are some things that can help us get to that. Not doing anything and letting the temperature go up to 2.5 or 3 degrees is not the way to do it, and is not a viable approach, at least and from our view. There may be people who say that. So I think there is a path that way. I know it is sort of said also that, well, SRM is uncertain. We don't understand it enough and we should do it. And I guess my response is to say, well, science is always somewhat uncertain. And it is true. There's some understanding, but there's a fair amount of research going into what solar radiation management can do and how it would help limit the intensification of tropical cyclones and do other things without doing significant other adverse effects. There is also significant uncertainty heading into the future without intervention. If you do intervention, we're going back to conditions where the climate is something we've experienced and the models have been tested against, and the models have simulated volcanic eruption effects, which is how one way of trying to do intervention. Whereas going into the future of 2.5 or 3 degrees, the models haven't been run in those conditions before. We don't have verification of that. And sort of the experience has been, as we've been getting warmer, the models sort of underestimate what's happened. They've underestimated sort of the change in climatic conditions of the mid-latitudes. We've been getting more extreme kinds of conditions. They make sense afterwards once you think about it, but the models haven't been picking those up so well. They've been lagging behind a bit. So I guess the question is, do you want to go to conditions that paleoclimatic experience says would be remarkably different and probably unsustainable, up 2.5 or 3 degrees, with potential significant sea level rise and maybe irreversible commitment to very large sea level rise in the future? Do you want to do that? Or do you want to say, well, I want to try and be at where we are or a bit lower in terms of global average temperature, doing it with, say, volcanic, imitating sort of continuous volcanic, starting small and adjusting as we go. There's a really interesting paper that I think is sort of almost coming out, but I heard about it at a webinar the other day, but it basically is an approach for optimizing the pattern of intervention that you would do, where you would put the different sulfate, how much, what seasons, what latitudes and stuff. Optimize it with respect to certain goals you want to achieve. So it could be a temperature increase, but it could be, my concern is doing it in a way that will allow the monsoons to continue. Doing it in a way that will try and minimize very hot heat waves and high heat index kind of conditions. You know, choosing some other goals that will help in reducing the disastrous kinds of effects that have been happening. And so there are ways starting to be able to do that, which makes it very interesting. Unfortunately, there's hardly any real effort and no negotiating discussion going on at high levels about considering this approach. And that just seems not the right way to go. So we're trying to get attention to that issue.
Can I just cite one issue that a previous guest brought up, which was creating a Damocles world where once you start doing this, we're in a highly vulnerable situation whereby if we stop doing it, we basically could have a whiplash effects which create more harm and destruction.
Well, that's one of the reasons that we want aggressive mitigation. The Damocles sword metaphor is really bad, assuming if emissions controls don't work and if CDR doesn't work. That's where it gets big. If we get good aggressive mitigation, and we get CDR starting to phase in to try and help pull CO2 down as well, or the effect of CO2 emissions down, then the Damocles sword isn't quite so bad. It's a smaller influence. And there's also the issue that I'm not trying to go back to pre-industrial conditions. If I go back to then there's this big 3-degree difference. If I go back to 1C conditions and I can keep it to 2.5, the amount of increase that would happen if for some reason it stopped, you know, would be considerably less. Now, people also say it's going to take money and attention away from mitigation. But one of the aspects of imitating this volcanic eruption is one of the concerns is it's so inexpensive to do that somebody might actually do it. And so it would be a little bit strange for countries to decide to stop doing it. Although if you're doing it for some period of time and people get used to it, they sort of wonder, is that really necessary? Can I stop it? Well, you could see pretty quickly if you stopped it, what would happen. We've just had an example of it sort of with what's been happening with respect to SO2 emissions coming off from ships and forming aerosols. So one of the things I've learned over my, I was thinking back, it's almost 60 years since I built one of the first climate models and stuff, is that climate change is not really random. The significant climate change is a result of something changing the energy balance. Over long times, it's been where continents are in different places and stuff, or it's been the rise of the Central America so that it makes the Atlantic Ocean colder and saltier and sort of drives the overturning circulation. But climate change occurs for a reason. And that's just pretty well illustrated with what's just happened when they've been cleaning up SO2 emissions from ships. And the SO2 concentration and the cloud brightness or even cloud existence in some of these regions has gone down and contributed to warming. So we have pretty good examples of it, you know, that that's the case. So would countries want to stop? Well, I don't know any countries that are really interested in having the situation keep getting worse. You know, there's certainly quite a few possibilities of how it could get worse. But, you know, I mean, if you say, well, maybe Canada and the Soviet Union want to melt areas where there's permafrost. Well, no, not really. I mean, you end up with very marshy land that's hard to get the resources out of if you're in Siberia. And you potentially could have much more CO2 and methane emissions coming out that would take conditions way beyond where we're headed now. So I don't think there are countries that really want it much warmer, you know, warmer than where we are. I think most would prefer, I'd rather be a bit less. So I don't have, you know, droughts in agricultural areas. So if you look at that Russia, for example, and its grain-producing regions, you say, and I've talked to a Russian scientist about this, I don't understand how water gets there to water those fields, okay? It can't come from the south over the Himalayas and the mountains to the south. It's an awful long way from the Atlantic Ocean to get all the way in there, and there's mountains along the way. Where does it come from? And they say, oh, it comes from snow in the winter, and then that snow melts and it adds to soil moisture, and you grow your crops while you have that soil moisture there. Well, if it gets too hot, all that soil moisture evaporates away before you get your crops done. So there are just difficulties for basically every nation if things keep getting warmer and hotter. So I think there would be much more likely to be some agreement to try and keep the levels down. What we have to do is, you know, where there's resistance, if you say, oh, well, you know, the United States is going to go and control the whole thing and do it. And you're going to say, well, wait a minute, I don't have confidence in that. I don't like that. And then that's exactly right. It's why a number of us haven't, you know, we're not pushing intervention early along in the system because the United States has not made the commitment to get emissions down. They were starting to under the last administration. Right now, we've got problems. But, you know, if you put it under United Nations control and the vulnerable nations have a real say in what happens to try and achieve sustainable development goals, you know, and it can be not just the low latitude ones, it could be the indigenous peoples of the north and some others and everything. And you would have a real debate. I think the sense would be, well, we don't really want to end it. We want to continue it. We might learn over time that we can, whether we should adjust it a bit below, down toward half a degree, or keep it up near one, or whatever. But those changes could occur slowly in time for groups, you know, to adapt. So you're right. I don't want the Damocles sword to fall and have a sudden 1 degree warming. But the alternative is, I don't think we're going to do very well at all at 2.5 or 3 degrees, where the Damocles sword equivalent is that the ice sheets are going to melt and they're going to cause rapid rise in sea level. I mean, if you look at the sea level projections in the last IPCC report, you see most of the solid lines for what would happen come in at less than a meter by 2100. But then there's this dashed line up there that got put in because in the review draft, the consideration of the review drafts, the scientists who came out with these lines said with high confidence it's going to be less than 1 meter by 2100. And a number of us wrote, including Sir David King and others, we got him to sort of lead in the writing of it, wrote and said, where did you possibly come that you have very high confidence it'd be less than a meter? And they said, well, there's one process we don't understand, okay? Scientists don't understand. And that's flowing ice sheets and calving, okay? So the ice going out that way. We can't model that. So we left that process out. We left that effect out. That's probably going to be the largest effect that will be happening in the ocean or something and having it cause sea level rise. They left it out. And I'm saying, you can't leave it out. You've got to, you know, give some indication. And so we'll put in this dashed line. And then, you know, there is this question of why did you stop saying it 2100? I mean, sea level is going to keep going up once you get it started. The glaciers go to lower altitude as you get it started. That makes them warmer. That makes them flow more. Greenland existing as a relic of the ice age, it was so tall that it was cold on top. And so it could stay that way. Now, they're having rain on top and it's getting warm on top, and that's going to accelerate melting. Once it gets going, it's really hard to stop. And that's 6 or 7 meters of sea level rise equivalent over some time scale or something, a few centuries maybe. So, holy Toledo, why just look at 2100? I'm worried about a commitment to sea level rise and this idea that we can go up to 2.5 and 3. That's the Damocles sword that I'm worried about.
Can you end by, if we took away a sort of a few of the political obstacles that exist today, and we said, you know, Mike, give us a pathway to greater research in the open air and some sort of deployment strategy, what would be your advice?
I think a number of us were looking to the Overshoot Commission that was formed as a way of trying to start getting at this question. That was a prominent group independent of government with some important leaders from around the world, former leaders from around the world, taking a look at it. And they pretty clearly indicated that it was likely we were going to overshoot this 1.5 level value from the Paris Accord. And what should one do about it? What's going to happen? What are the consequences? It certainly seems, if you read the IPCC reports of what the consequences are when you get up there, it becomes very severe and intolerable. I mean, the World Bank did some studies maybe a decade ago about the world at 3 or 4 degrees C, and it looked at various places in the world. And if you're in the Southeast Asia, which is low-lying, it basically said sea level rise is going to be a huge issue with salt water coming into all the areas that grow rice. If you look at Africa, the issue of drought is just going to grow and become very severe, and can it provide food for all its people? They looked at, you know, different regions of the country, and all of them were getting to very serious situations. Are there ways to potentially deal with that? You want some consideration by some high-level bodies that are open to thinking about and listening to reasoning about all of this and trying to make judgments. As I sort of said at the start, we're scientists, and when the word should comes up, you got to be hesitant because there's all these other considerations to make. And what we need is some sort of advisory group or body of respected people who will take a look at it and will help getting discussion going in bodies like the sustainable development components of the United Nations to think about, well, what's going to happen if we just can't stop much further climate change, doubling where we are essentially in terms of the increase in global average temperature, with potential tipping points recognized by scientists up there, like thawing of permafrost, which could release all kinds of more carbon and basically take climate out of the potential of control from us, from everybody. So I think we just have to get some high-level discussion. This group I'm with, the Healthy Planet Action Coalition, is really trying to stimulate that, is get some consideration of it. Don't sort of automatically write it off. I mean, what it seems right now is there's this group tied to we can do it by mitigation because the technological potential is there. And that's, you know, that's potentially true, but it's going to take time. There's a lot to do to replace 80% of the world's energy supply, which is what you have to do. And if there's no energy, if we lose energy, there'll be riots in the streets and all kinds of deaths that occur. So, you know, it isn't an alternative that you can suddenly say, oh, I'm just going to stop putting out CO2 and we'll let the world go on. That isn't a viable approach. So can we come up with a credible approach? And a group of us are basically saying, we think climate intervention has to be part of that and has to be something we do. I hate putting this obligation onto future generations. You know, that's, as I say, you know, the United States was considered the issue 60 years ago early on. It's just a real shame that the nations of the world have dawdled so long. We've known about this issue for quite some time. You know, there's the young people have, you know, a very strong case to make against what's been happening. One of the things I've done in my retirement is, you know, it's help on some of these lawsuits that have been involved in trying to get governments to pay attention. This is a huge intergenerational issue, and we need to be doing something much more about it. And somehow it's no longer the case that mitigation alone can accomplish what we need to do.
Well, look, Mike, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me about it.
You're welcome.
If you are concerned about the future, then why not travel with me through every COP conference from COP21 in Paris to COP28 in Dubai by ordering my book, COP Out, How Governments Have Failed the People on Climate. In COP Out, you'll gain insights into what is actually going on in these supposed world-saving conferences and how we have ended up in this dire era of dangerous consequences. You can order COP Out via the link in the notes or on any online bookstore worldwide. in paperback or audio version.
That was Nick Breeze talking with Dr. Mike McCracken on why we might need geoengineering sooner rather than later. Nick also recommends his April 2025 interview with Professor Raymond Pierre Humbert on the dangers of solar geoengineering. Find that on YouTube on the Nick Breeze channel, Climate Gen, or Nick's website at gen.cc. That's gen with two N's, .cc. We are lucky to have Nick finding key climate scientists to talk about their work. I put some links to major voices warning against geoengineering, whether it is tests or one country deciding to change the world's climate, all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. In addition to Humbert, check out what Bill McKibben and Jeff Goodall say. Geoengineering has been covered in at least half a dozen Radio EcoShock shows. Try Shade of the Future, posted May 22, 2024. Longtime journalist and filmmaker Dr. Gwyn Dyer says yes in his new book, Intervention Earth, Life-Saving Ideas from the World's Climate Engineers. Australian author Clive Hamilton on geoengineering and his new book is Earth Masters. That was back in 2013, but it's still a really essential read. And then going back to 2009 in my show Geoengineering Bye Bye Blue Skies, top climate scientist Alan Robach lays out a laundry list of reasons why trying to control the climate may not be such a good idea. And way, way back in 2008, newcomer Alex Smith interviewed Mike McCracken about sudden and abrupt climate change. Here's a quick 2-minute sample from that program.
Michael McCracken is the chief scientist for the Climate Institute in Washington, D.C. He's a past president of the International Association of Meteorology and Atmospheric Sciences. Can you begin by telling us what is abrupt climate change?
Well, the general perception has been that the climate will sort of gradually shift as the concentration of CO2 rises in the atmosphere. But I think what we're finding is, and if you look at the historical record, the Earth history, you see the potential for rather sudden changes, for it to change in jumps and starts. The Earth's sort of a finite size. The wave patterns of the atmospheric circulation can go one way around a mountain, or gradually they can shift and go another way around. And so you end up getting shifts or surprisingly rapid changes. And we're trying to point out that that's much more possible than it's been considered in the past.
That was Dr. Michael McCracken on Radio EcoShock in January 2008. All of this from Climate Gen and Radio EcoShock and the media and the science are easy to check out using links in my weekly show blog. It is always free and ad-free at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening this week and caring about the future for all.
Oh, stand in line.